Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming for this intersession. It's organized by Washington Management Subcommittee. So our committee mostly focuses on the investment side within the institute. So also we are going to have another one similar event in Melbourne sometime in the following months. Also we budget for 4 events every year. So we still have 2 more outstanding events. So if anyone interested in any topics, please send an email to us, and then we can try to organize the event around it. So today we are very lucky to have Dr. Jeff Warren. He did a very big research on long-term investment, which is super interesting, and I think you will enjoy the presentation today. Without further ado, let me introduce to Jeff, who is going to present on this very interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Henry, and thank you all for coming out at lunchtime and hearing what I've got to say. Hopefully you'll prove it interesting, and if there's one or two takeaways, that'll be great, because if you get one or two things from these presentations, you're usually doing pretty well. Hopefully I'll get you more than one or two. So we're going to talk about long-term investing from an institutional investor perspective today. Before I get into it, you're probably asking, what is this CIFA, Centre for International Finance and Regulation? We're a government-funded research centre, so the federal government and the New South Wales government provides most of our funding, and we're set up as a consortium that does research in collaboration with industry partners and with academics. We fund some academic research and we do some internally. And what you're seeing today is basically one of those internal research projects which I did most of the work in collaboration with the Future Fund, who we got together and said, is there any project that we can do? And we sort of decided that long-term investing was interesting for both of us. So I went beavering away on it with their assistance. So the agenda, what we're going to talk about today, I'm going to give you a brief overview of the research itself. I'm going to then talk about what characterises a long-term investor, what makes them long-term. Then some of the benefits of being a long-term investor, some advantages and strategies. And I'm going to do a bit of a drill down on two strategies that a long-term investor might pursue, and that is, what's the benefit of investing in liquid assets, potentially, and what I call dynamic strategies. Then we're going to talk about some of the pitfalls to avoid, some of the hurdles you need to overcome. So what makes long-term investing so difficult to do? In other words, why don't we see more long-term investing out there? And what's some of the solution to certain problems? And then how you might design an investment organisation for long-term investing. I'm just going to touch on that very, very briefly. So about the research. So it's taken the perspective of an institutional investor, an asset owner if you want, like a superannuation fund or a sovereign wealth fund. As I mentioned, undertaken with conjunction with the Future Fund. They essentially provide a bit of guidance, insight and examples. In the third, there's a lot of papers here, but in the third of the trilogy, they provide some examples about how they approach certain things. So there's a number of outputs. There was a major report which had 3 papers in it, dealt with the determinants of investment horizon, the pitfalls and benefits, and designing an investment organisation, and 2 subsequent spin-off ones. One was long-term investing as an agency problem, which I did actually get David Neal to put his name on that, which I was happy with, because a lot of the ideas from that came from David, and also one about performance evaluation around long-term investing. So they're all on the CIFA website. If you go to CIFA long-term investing in Google, they'll pop up, and it'll take you to SSRN where they can all be downloaded if there's any interest in following up. So let's get into it, and let's talk about characterising a long-term investing. Fund people usually come at this pretty simply. They just think it's something to do with your time horizon. I don't think it's that simple. And in fact, when I started to dig around in the literature to work out what was the definition of a long-term investor, I could not find a clean and tidy definition, and nor could I find any theory about investment horizon. Might be out there, but I wasn't able to find it in everything I was digging around it, which was quite interesting. So, having thought through it and looking at some of the existing research and the existing definitions, I came up with thinking there's 2 indicators that really characterise what is a long-term investor. And if you've got a long-term investor, you should see these 2 attributes. within them in some way. They should have both of these attributes. And the first is a discretion over trading. This is almost a necessary condition to be a long-term investor, and it's closely related to your funding. Now, through the presentation, I'm going to talk about ways in which this is used. But basically, it gives you the discretion to hold for the long run if you so desire to do so. Whereas if your funding is taking, you know, your funders are taking money off you, you have to trade. Or they're giving you money, you have to trade. Okay? Or your boss says, not good enough, you're out of here, next guy in, next guy will trade, turn the portfolio over. Okay? So you lose discretion over trading. So that's a very important characteristic, almost a necessary condition.
Just on that, so for example, the Middle East and Southern World funds are probably set up as, long-term investors, but deploying oil prices.
Oh, hold on. We're being recorded, so I think... question coming.
So the sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East were probably set up with this sort of discretion over trading,
yes.
Long-term approach, but the fall in the oil price in those countries around the world has caused many of them to be sellers.
Yes.
So is that a kind of...
a fail.
yeah, they're no longer a long-term
investor. An unexpected fail.
Yeah.
Yeah, they expected the pass on that one. Yeah. And you can guess where I'm heading here. Most of the industry is set up as open-ended unit trusts where the money can flow in and out. And that actually is shown to be costly to investors in the pool. And it inhibits taking a long-term view. The way the remuneration structures are set up, it doesn't encourage discretion over trading. Okay. So it's a really important part of the puzzle. The second one is an approach to investing, and I think here the information sets you use and the way the investment approach itself are all important here. And so it's not just having the capability to be a long-term investor, you also have to act like one. And I think the easiest way to think about this distinction is between investing and trading. So a trader is worried about the near-term price change. How they do it depends on whether the value of your asset goes up or down. Whereas an investor can be worried about the long-term drivers of returns, long-term drivers of value, and is usually cash flow focused. So they're worried about, do I buy good companies? Do they have a competitive advantage if they're an equity investor? Are they managed by good people? Do they use their cash wisely? Will they, they have good investment opportunities? Can they generate value for me in the long run? And I'll stick with them. The trader says, stop that. Don't care about that. What I care about is who's buying and selling, will they push the price up tomorrow or not? And if the price is going up, I'm on board. If there's lots of sellers out there on the seller, if there's a news flow around that stock, like we get a result, I'm worried about, whether the result will be above or below expectations. Get it? See the different sort of mindset? And in fact, the best definition of long-term investing, or one of the good ones I found, was that it talked about it as a mindset or a frame of mind, and I think that's probably a better way to look at it. What I haven't mentioned so far is investment horizon. I'm going to spend a bit of time saying why I think holding period is not the measure of whether you're a long-term investor or not. And the trick here is long-term investors do not need to hold for the long period. They only need to set their sights on the long term. It's a matter of frame of mind or perspective. And in fact, if you dig into the academic literature, it was always there. If you go back to Merton, early 1970s and the rest of it, optimal control and the rest of it, what's the optimum path to maximise your long-term returns? It doesn't say you shouldn't trade. There's only certain conditions under which you don't. It says you optimise the long-term path. And that means that holding period itself is not an indicator of a long-term investor. So let's do an audience poll, at least in Sydney. Consider the following. So you're a long-term investor. You buy an asset, and you think it offers you strong growth in cash flows over the next 20 years, and when you discount it back, you get an expected rate of return of 15%. Now tomorrow, the market wakes up and agrees with you. The asset price suddenly triples. The expected return drops by 6%. Not because the cash flows have changed, but simply the price has tripled, so the internal rate of return has dropped. And there's other assets that offer you better than 6% in the same risk class. So what do you do? Do you A, continue to hold because you're a long-term investor and I bought this for the long term, or B, do you sell and direct the proceeds elsewhere? Who would hold? Hands up. Who would continue to hold? Who would sell? Oh, sorry, we've got some hold. So we've got about, I was too quick there, but I think we've got about a 4-to-1. I'm arguing it should be B. And that's totally fine for a long-term investor to do that. But I've noticed when I do this to different audiences, I often get different results. I've had audiences which go the other way as well. So it is a point of contention. I'm going to drive this home a little bit more, and I'm going to talk about four investors. The ones I really want to talk about is B and C. But let's establish the bookends first up. Down the short end of the horizon is investor A. They're a short-term investor. Their horizon is the end of the next period. They're myopic. What they want to do is maximise their one-period return. And what do they care about? They care about the price changes. It's like if you hold a stock for a year, the dividend might be 4%. Whether you get 20% plus 20 or minus 20 will depend on what happens to the price and what pushes it around. Okay? So that's your short-term investor. Investor D is your ultra long-term investor, perpetuity. We're just going to buy our asset and hold it forever. We never sell. All that matters to you is not prices at all. What matters is the cash that is generated by that asset. And by the way, out of that, reinvestment is pretty important. I've done some sums on this, and you'll find reinvestment actually matters more than the dividends or other cash that's generated in the interim. It's what happens to that cash that actually matters, what the management does with it. Investor B and C are somewhere in between. They've both got an interim horizon. The way most people often think about this is investor B. Medium to long-term horizon, some future endpoint. It's a buy and hold and liquidate. So what I'm interested in is my holding period return, the end price, plus any cash flows that are paid out, plus also if there's any cash flows that are not paid and reinvested, what return they get, and that will generate your return. What I'm arguing is that, no, investor C is the way you should look at this. You've got the same future endpoint, but you're willing to trade along the way. And so what your question then is, what cash is generated, what do I get from reinvestment, and also what's my optimal strategy to maximise my value over that horizon? Should I trade in and out? And I'd argue it's okay for long-term investors to do that. They can sit anywhere along that spectrum, but I think trading is okay. So that's the way I'm looking at it. So if you're able to do that, if you have discretion over trading and you have an investment approach that allows you, lends itself to viewing, taking a long-term view, what advantages do you hold over the more short-term orientated investors in the market? Well, first one I'm going to offer is a very trite advantage. You have the overarching advantage of a broader opportunity set. That is, you're able to do everything a short-term investor could do, particularly if you don't have a mental blockage against trading, and you can do some more things because you're not going to be forced to trade. But that's very much a trite answer. It doesn't have any meat in it. It just says, okay, there's more opportunity there. It's how you exploit those opportunities that really matter. And I'd argue there's three sort of general areas here, and these general areas will lead into some strategies you might look at. So the three specific advantages are, firstly, you have the capacity to adopt and hold positions with an uncertain payoff timing. That means you don't care about when the payoff arrives, you care about if the payoff will arrive eventually. Doesn't matter if it arrives tomorrow, as long as eventually I get my jam, I get my payback. And an example of that, a very good one, is value investing. Often value investors, I'll use an equity example, they're going and buying companies which have something wrong with them, where the market's worried about where the catalysts are for the turnaround. They may look like there's good value there, but you never know when the market's going to come to realise that there's value there and push the price up. Often it requires that company to give you an upwards earnings surprise and the market thinks, oh, maybe it's not as bad as it was and it starts to be re-rated and so on. The key thing is you don't know when the payoff's coming. And if you're a long-term investor, you can sit there and wait. Long-term themes also fit in that category, I think. You don't know when the payoff will... You know, if you're investing on climate change, the market didn't care about climate change for years, starting to focus on it now and derating coal stocks and the rest of it. You could have taken that view of that theme years ago and waited for a long while before a market adjustment came. The second thing you can do, and I'm raising this again to point towards the type of strategies a long-term investor might try to exploit, and is you can exploit opportunities generated by short-term investors. So some of the activity in the markets is the footprints of a short-term investor with a short-term objective pushing prices around. And what you can do is you don't have the same risks and the same concerns as those short-term investors. You can take the other side of the trade and sit back and wait. And some examples of that, I think, are risk premium capture. So a lot of the risk premiums in the market you observe, and I've got a list of them in a moment, are to do with the fact that there's concerns by shorter-term investors about a transitory risk or a short-term risk, and they'll pay somebody to take the risk off it. It's a risk transfer thing. Also, providing liquidity during liquidity crisis when it's valued is another thing where a short-term investor may have redemption, has to sell, forced seller, cheap price, you can take the other side. And again, that will go with the first advantage that you don't care when the payoff comes, you can sit there and wait for it. The third one, and I put this as third because usually when long-term investing is mentioned, this is what pops out of everybody's mouth as the first advantage, the ability to invest in unlisted or illiquid assets. Yes, it is an advantage. It widens your opportunity set, gives you better avenues for diversification and opportunities to add values to the assets through engagement or control. I agree with all that. I actually think that's the third advantage and not the major one. And I'm going to drill down on the nature of that advantage in this talk a bit later. So thinking through that, come up with eight strategies that might be suited to long-term investors because they exploit some of those advantages. So there's risk premium captures. You could argue the market risk premium or the equity risk premium is due to the fact that there's investors out there who are worried about short-term risk, so they price equities to generate high long-term returns. The volatility risk premium can be tied to that. The liquidity risk premium, commodities backwardation, reinsurance premiums. So catastrophe insurance, for example, would be the insurers putting off their catastrophe risk, for instance, and offering a high rate of return to do so, and a long-term investor might be the sort of person who could take that year after year after year and collect the premiums, and so on. Liquidity provision I'll talk about. Value investing I've already touched on. Another one, pricing discrepancies across segmented markets. Problem here is open-ended timing. So if I'm long property in one market and short in another because I think they're out of kilter, you never quite know when the market's going to address that pricing inconsistency. If you have the ability to sit there and wait for it to happen, you can take a long-term view. Long-term capital management was trying to do the same sort of thing, but didn't quite make it. Long-term and thematic investing I've talked about. I've touched on control and engagement, which is really ESG or SRI activities. Complex assets, this is an instance where you have a discount for the opaqueness of the asset that will take time to resolve. They may, if you can buy them at a discount, sometimes complex assets are at a premium. You can watch what you pay. And finally, dynamic strategies. Dynamic strategies are where you're maximising the path by trying to sell when the expected return is high and buy when it's low. As I said, I'm going to talk about that later, but it also has another dimension, and that's viewing cash as an option to buy later. Sure.
Just on the thematic investing, so you might be taking a long-term view, but the current sort of sentiment around a particular idea is really strong.
So let's take, for example, the internet boom in the late 90s. You are taking a long-term view that the internet is going to change everything, and you might be right on that. But because current market sentiment, everyone's seeking the same thing, you pay outrageously high prices and destroy a lot of value. So how do you kind of balance those two things?
I think you answered it. You have to balance those two things. Yeah, absolutely. a better example was, I think, the climate change one, if you go back a few years, because, you know, I was amazed that there was no discussion in any brokers' reports about, that I could see, about the risk that some of these assets might end up as stranded one day if the need to fight climate change got traction. And it didn't happen until it happened, and then all of a sudden it happens. And so I think that's a better example. So you could say the market wasn't focused on it, wasn't priced, but I wouldn't be buying tech stocks in 2000.
I think you've deliberately avoided saying that the long term was more than 1 year or any given time. You've used the word period up there, and I think you're defining long term as being longer than the short term people. No, well, I'm interested to see where that's coming from or where it's going to. We've all heard about these traders who define the long term as anything more than 10 minutes. Is it the thinking that these sort of principles could be applied to be longer term than whoever's driving the market?
Yes, I think so. That's probably a good way of looking at it. And in fact, I'll come back to this theme later. That one of the, this again gets to the opportunities. You remember my second opportunity is being on the other side of shorter term investors. Part of that is you do have a longer horizon by then, and you try to work out situations where market dislocation has been caused by people in the market having too short a focus, by implication, a shorter focus than what you've got. So I think that's absolutely right. So you could define it as longer than the market. I prefer to leave it sort of open and just say, look, we're focused on a path. Maximising a path through to something that's very long term. And I've got in the back of my mind, like a sovereign wealth fund, I think, NZ Super or the Future Fund, where they don't even have to sort of meet their requirements for quite a few years yet, getting closer to that. Where you've got a superannuation fund, if it could do it, it's funding liabilities in terms of people spending will go out for the next few decades. I've got those sort of things in the back of my mind, I'd say, but I have intentionally left it non-discreet. We did take a poll once at one event, or the opening event, and I think the consensus was 7 years. We had Jack Gray. If any of you know Jack Gray, he was at it, and he basically said he suggested 7 years because it was biblical. But that's, if you know Jack, you'll understand where that comes from. Okay, I might push on now. And I'm going to drill down on two particular areas. Illiquid assets as a source of opportunity. What I've done is I've picked something that I thought might be relevant for this particular audience, which is basically the Actuaries Institute. So you'll be dealing with illiquidity all the time. So I think the way that I'm going to offer is firstly a way to look at this, and then I'm going to link it into how it relates to long-term investing. So how do you look at illiquidity? Let's start off like this. Firstly, when you invest in an asset, you have an expected net return. And you can think of it actually in two parts. One is the market delivers you a return, a gross market return. That's what you get, the dividends you're giving you from the market, and the price you buy that in the market and the price you sell it. Most of the time, that's what's in the databases. But you also have costs of investing. And they could be the costs of buying in terms of, and exiting in terms of transaction costs. And it could be the cost of having a management capability to invest in it. It could be a management expense ratio or something like that. So that's the broad framework. I don't think anybody could disagree with that. That's your net return. So net return is what matters and what should be matter. But it's not what you actually observe in most of the databases. Most of the databases report gross returns. So as soon as you get I'm using equities because that's where I come from. As soon as you get an equity database that goes closing price, right, and opening price, and then dividend, you add them up, that's the gross return. It doesn't tell you what that, if you went and bought or sold something in the market, what you actually would have bought and sold out of the day. You've got a BR spread there, you've got market impact and so on. So I put all that in the costs. So cost is not usually observed, but the other thing that's really important about the cost is costs vary for each investor. So everybody gets a different net return. And some of this will link into long-term investing. and it varies across time. So what makes up your gross market return? What return will the market deliver you in an illiquid investment? You can think of it as two components. Firstly, there's a return you get on a totally liquid equivalent, the same asset which is totally liquid. And secondly, then there's a compensation for illiquidity on top of that. So what the market will price an asset for is to deliver you the return on liquid plus a compensation for the costs and risks associated with illiquidity. And those are the expected costs from buying and selling. So one of the, and I'm going to talk about drill down costs in a moment, and also an illiquidity risk premium, because illiquidity is a risk. So this is, it's where the costs come into play, that it's in that compensation for illiquidity where the opportunity is, and where long-term investors are better placed. And that cost, and drilling down on the cost now, it's a function of three things. Firstly, there's your entry cost. So when you go into a stock, you know your entry cost. You usually know what it costs you to trade you on the way in, unless you have a choice of paying that cost or not. Where this sort of differs for long-term investors is, let's say it's a very illiquid asset. The cost of trading in that, if it's illiquid, is larger. Usually, not only, I'm talking about more fees here, but it's usually more market impact. You've got to sell it at a larger discount to get out of the liquid assets. Let's say it's 10% of the value of the asset that you've got to give up to get out. If you, or get in. If you spend 10% up front to get in, and you hold it for 1 year, it takes 10% off your return for a year. Very roughly, if you hold it for 10 years, it takes 1% per annum. If you hold it for 20, it takes half. So what happens is that cost gets amortized longer the longer you hold it. More importantly, the exit cost is really where it's at, because you don't know what it's going to cost you to exit an asset. Again, you've got the market impact costs. But if you're a long-term investor, you have the advantage of discretion over trading, and you can choose when you exit and at what price, or indeed when you exit at all. So a short-term investor who has to trade, has to sell, has to take the discount, and may end up with their returns hurt as a consequence. A true long-term investor says, okay, I've got this trade-off. Do I sell it? Do I take the market impact costs at this price, or do I continue to hold? And they can work their way around this cost of exit to a greater extent. And they're also not faced with the risk of being a forced seller, because somebody's redeemed and you have to sell and have to take the discount. So the costs and the risks of exit are less acute, a lot less acute, if you're a genuine long-term investor with discretion over trading. And then you've got other costs, which is whenever you go into a liquid asset, they're usually more expensive to manage for a whole range of different reasons. So what happens is, this compensation for liquidity out there is compensation really for two things. One is, it's a compensation for the greater costs of trading in liquid assets, both on the way in and on the way out, and on the way through managing it. And it's also a compensation for the risk that illiquidity is like taxis, I like to say. It's always there when you don't want them, and when you want one, you can't find one. It's like illiquidity, you can't find liquidity, and that you're a forced seller. You could be a forced seller at a big discount at the wrong time. So with that framework, what's the advantage held by long-term investing? So they're less impacted by the cost and risk of illiquidity because of discretion over trading. The lower exposure to the higher cost of investing in liquid assets mainly relates to transaction costs on the cost it takes you to get into the asset, right, are amortized over a longer holding period, or at least you have the discretion to amortize them over a longer holding period. You also have the discretion to choose the condition of exits, which means you manage those trade-offs. You can decide whether to exit or not, or at what price. And the other costs of locating investments are lower as well. You've also got lower exposure to the higher risks associated with investing in liquid assets, because you're never a forced seller. You can always choose to hold, and you can ride through, if not to exploit liquidity crises. And I'll touch on that during dynamic strategies. So this raises a question, though. If I go back to this, what is really important is what determines that third bit in the second equation, third term, the compensation for illiquidity. That's really the critic. How big is that will determine how much of an opportunity a long-term investor can get in the liquid assets. So what determines it? It's the marginal investor. This is really critical. There's an assumption out there when it comes to illiquidity that if you buy a liquid asset, you will be rewarded for it because it's illiquid and you get a premium. I hear that all the time. Buy liquid assets, you get a premium. Not the way to look at it. I can tell you now, the major investors like the Future Fund do not look at it that way. They don't presume there's a liquidity premium all the time. What's central is who the marginal investor is in the market at a particular point of time. And what they need to be compensated for the marginal costs and the marginal risks associated with illiquidity. So this gets back to the question earlier. A long-term investor will benefit if the marginal investors have short horizons and are factoring in large costs for illiquidity and large risks, and you have a longer horizon than them. Then you're likely to be offered a premium. But it means a premium may not be available in some markets. The premium may fluctuate through time because the marginal investor fluctuates. And the ebb and flow of liquidity also, on the other hand, may provide a source of opportunity for investors. And this leads into my dynamic strategies. You know, in other words, they basically are buyers and liquidity prices and sellers when everybody is hankering over each other to get a slice of that asset and pushing the price up. You can exploit that. So a premium might not be available in some markets. I would argue unlisted infrastructure, and by the way, this came from a couple of big investors, has a negative liquidity premium in it at the moment. A negative liquidity premium. You are not getting a liquidity premium in unlisted infrastructure. Why? Because that asset class is populated by a whole lot of money, a whole lot of people with money to invest who have decided to allocate assets into unlisted infrastructure, and they're out there looking for assets and competing for them and bidding them up. What it's saying is the marginal investor is not valuing the costs and risks of illiquidity. They're desperate to get set because money has been earmarked to go into illiquidity. And in fact, where you're more likely to get illiquidity is, this is something Andrew Ung came up with from Columbia, is it says maybe the illiquidity premium is actually in the listed markets like equities and bonds. Why would you think that? They're liquid. But the investors who populate that market care about liquidity. So what they do is they price the liquid equities higher than really liquid equities, and they price illiquid bonds such as credit and junk bonds at a higher price than very liquid things like government bonds. So it makes sense. But if you look at it through the prism of who is the marginal investor and do they price their liquidity, you can immediately see just because an asset's illiquid doesn't mean it will give you a illiquidity premium. What you need is people in that market to be short-term investors. So where you get an illiquidity premium in something like property is when you go through a property crisis and there's all these geared people out there who are forced to dump their property on the market. Then there's an illiquidity premium. The marginal investor is a forced seller. So I think you can get the sense of what I'm saying. You can get an illiquidity premium, but it's not going to be there all the time. And it's only going to be there when the marginal investor has a shorter horizon than you do. So that's illiquidity.
Sorry, it's an awesome question, but how do you know that you're not going to be that investor? So, for example,
The Future Fund set up with a long-term goal. Government could change and say, sorry, we're going to close the Future Fund, we want to liquidate the assets, pay back government debt, and suddenly you thought you were the long-term investor, but you're now a forced seller. So how do you kind of contemplate that in your own investment that you may actually be paying the exit premium?
Well, one of my solutions is to try and manage this as best as you can, but what happens with the Future Fund and the NZ Super, there's sort of an undertaking in legislation that you can't draw down on it for a number of years. So it's getting closer all the time. So it's arising. Then you don't know what happens. It could be a change in government or circumstances. You've got to make an evaluation of that, I guess, or manage it. And unfortunately, a lot happens. A lot of the industry does not have the discretion to manage this. They just you know, they're open-ended funds. Part of my solutions would be design more use closed-end funds more broadly, allow people to commit their money for long-term on the undertaking. You can offer them long-term investing and things like that. But yes, it is an issue. And it needs to be recognised or managed, I think. Okay, so let's push on to dynamic strategies. I've got to watch my time here, because I think I was going to say 40 minutes, but we did have some questions on the way through. Okay, what's a dynamic strategy? The underlying concept here is you're trying to exploit time-varying expected returns with a view to maximising the outcome over the long run, which I mentioned earlier, but this is in the academic literature, I'm Merton and in the discrete time, Campbell and Vassera. Vassera is the main references there, all the guys who talked about it first. And I've done some analysis around this, and I'd like you to think of it two ways. As a long-term investor, you have a choice if you're looking at an asset. One is you can go long if you invest in that asset and commit to it. The other choice you have is you can hold cash. You get low expected returns, but what it does do, it acts as an option. You know, it can hold out to buy, potentially down the track, at a lower price. And so think of that as two strategies that you could adopt. And there's a question here, what's the optimal mix between the two? Because I'm actually not necessarily saying the optimal mix is 100% invested. The optimal mix might be a bit of both, holding some aside to invest later. And what are the motivations? Most people, when you think about this, they immediately take the view it's a mean reverting strategy, and it is to a large extent. That is, let's buy when the assets are low and expected returns are high, and let's sell when assets are high and expected returns are low. Okay, and hope that the expected returns mean revert and we get a kicker on the side. Yes, that is that there. But there's also these two other dimensions to these sort of strategies. And one is cash as an option, as I was describing before. The second is risk reduction. This might not be obvious, but when markets are really high, like the tech boom in 2000, sitting in cash and accepting a low return might actually be a risk reduction strategy because it protects your capital and avoids the exposure to capital loss. So there's more sort of strings to this bow than just mean reversion. And as was mentioned earlier in liquidity, it may be a likely source of opportunity for short-term investors where they've been forced to trade due to funding flows, and this sets up your opportunity to buy cheaply and sell high because other people are being forced to trade because they don't have discretion over trading and they have to trade because they've lost funds or they've got funds or they're worried about how they're performing versus their benchmark or other sorts of things. Those sort of behaviours we see in the market. A long-term investor can be on the other side. What I did, you'll find in the second paper, is I did two sort of pieces of analysis. This is something I want to develop further going forward, but I did two pieces of analysis. I did a simple tree model, up and down, like what do we do now with the cash and fully invested sort of options within it. And we also brought those concepts to an applied example where we did just a very, very simple strategy in direct property. And I've sort of got a sense for it here. This chart is just the cap rate on CBD property in Australia. Dynamically estimated buy and sell points, you know, at each point of time. Like in this case, at neutral, we start at neutral. We sell there, didn't quite buy there. We bought there, we sold there. Very long period, if you notice, it goes back to 30 years or so, but there's only a few buy and sell points on that. But it was just trying to demonstrate with a simple signal what the dynamic reverting type strategy may look like. What that line is the relative performance of the strategy versus a simple just staying long in property all the way through. Interesting thing is it didn't really actually significantly outperform. But what you did find, you can't really see it from this chart, but it actually had a lower risk. It didn't have a lot of outperformance. It had a higher Sharpe ratio because it actually avoided some of the collapses and things like that. So that's the risk reduction aspect. So what came out of doing this sort of analysis? As I just hinted, dynamic strategies of this type offer the opportunity to reduce risk as much as they increase return. And that's the other side of things. It's not a matter of just buying cheap assets. It's also about being able to avoid being in the market when it's too high and about to collapse. That's quite valuable. Actually, think about it for a moment. How many investors out there could say, equity markets are totally overvalued, I'm out of here, I'm going to sit in cash? How many people could do that? I can't think of many. Most super funds can't. They've sold their 70-30 fund. It's expected to be 70-30. They can't immediately switch it to 30-70. If you're an equity fund manager, you're expected to be 100% invested in equities. This discretion is rare. I noticed the future fund reading the press has been building up cash. So it has a long-term horizon. You can sort of see how they're saying, okay, the opportunities aren't there, we're happy to sit in cash. I think they're exploiting this sort of approach. David Neal had a term for it he picked up from someone called crocodile investing. You know, sitting here waiting and going, come on. I think that was good. I like that. Cash has an option value, as I mentioned, but when I'm doing the simulations, this is the bit I think really needs to be modelled properly, but it has a time dimension. One of the problems I had there, see that underperformance relative to just being in property, the reason why that occurred is because we went long, we closed it out there when we got back below the mean, and then we just sat in there, and meanwhile what's happening is property is generating a bit of return to cash. So you're underperforming, being, I think it was 25% in cash and 75% invested, and that goes for around about the best part of 10 or 12 years, okay? So just think of this. You're doing this strategy because you're sitting out of the market waiting for the opportunity with 25% cash, but that opportunity has taken 12 years to emerge. 12 years! And meanwhile, you're underperforming. How are you going to explain that? I don't know, it's not easy. Okay? So this is just how hard, I'm just trying to say, these sound good, but you can't do this without saying, okay, I've got cash, I'm crocodile investing, you need your meal soon. The meal's got to float past, you know, within a reasonable period of time, or you might starve. I also found the optimal mix depends on pricing at the start. So when I did the tree model, you were able to work out which mix optimised the prospective start, sharp ratio, and it worked out that depending on how calibrated the pricing was, it tells you, so more overvalued the market was, the more you held cash at the start, the cheaper it was, maybe you're 100% invested. That makes an eminent sense, but it's worth thinking that it's not just always 70-30 I found was optimal in the middle of the range, but otherwise when you reach either extreme, you don't do that. I've already discussed the relative performance risk is one of the big hurdles in this type of investing. So anyway, that's dynamic strategies. A quick run through it. It's in the paper if you want to read more about it. Let's go on to the pitfalls. I'm going to talk about the pitfalls and the hurdles, but I'm going to concentrate on two aspects of this in particular. But the main problem here, this is really the nub of the issue, is that when you're investing for the long run, you're investing for payoffs that may not arrive for any time soon. They could take a number of years to come. You don't know when, right? It's open-ended payoff. And that brings forth a whole range of challenges. Basically, you don't know whether you're going to be successful or not, and you're not going to get information on it soon. This is quite different to a short-term investment, where you know if it was successful or not pretty quickly, right? The market's either told you you're successful or it's told you you'll fail. So it brings forth two main groups of challenges. One is you've got to forecast over long horizons. This is an implementation issue, but you find the problem of forecasting over long horizons interrelates with organizational and behavioral things to make it really difficult to sort of sustain long-term perspective. And that second group, I put them underneath agency or organisational things. And the problem here is that in the intervening period, most of what, remember what I'm talking here about investment management organisations. I mean, most of them are arranged as a series of principal-agent relations where agents need to monitor the principals and decide what to do. And that's where the problem comes with the combination of long-term investing. So let's drill down on that. But before we do, we'll talk about long-term investing is hard to forecast. You should all know this. I'm pretty old. I started my career as an analyst in the early 1980s, about 83 or 84. This is what I remember when I started my career, not that long ago in the terms of long-term investing. Markets were driven by inflation fears, and guess what? Interest rates were 15 to 20%. PE ratios above 10 times in the stock market were considered to be far too expensive. Nobody wanted to pay more than 10 times for a stock. The media companies were highly priced, and Australian banks were considered uninspiring, boring investments. They're on PEs of about 4 or 5. The PC had just been invented, and there wasn't any thought of anything like the internet. When you look back at it and you think, okay, well, it is a fair while ago, but you know, it's about 30 or 35 years, it's forecasting the long term is just so hard to do. There's constant potential for regime shifts. Outcomes, when you look out over the horizon, proliferate. There's many things that can happen. You have hazy feedback loops. You can forecast something to happen in 20 years' time. You're not going to find out if you're wrong or not straight away. You can sit there hoping that you're still going to be right for a long while before you find out that you're actually wrong. And if your expectations of the future go wrong, it often all goes pear-shaped. You've got this. You've been committed to this view. It's not working out. Getting out of your, you may discover it all too late. Getting out of your investments is hard. All this is really difficult. Short-term investors don't have that problem. What they can do is that they can put in stop losses, and they can reset their positions often. They can continually recalibrate. That's a real advantage of short-term investing. It's a lot more flexible to handle changes in the situation. So what do you do? Very hard to get over this, but I've tried to put up some here, what I think are some of the answers to the problems of predicting the long run. First thing, this came up in the question earlier, is favour positions which you can see are due to the actions of short-term investing. So a classic example would be that, is that I can see four sellers in the market forcing this asset price down because they're desperate to get out. That is a really high quality investment because I know why it's there, I know why it's cheap. I'm not relying on my view of the future. What I'm relying on is that some poor short-term investor is getting carted out and I can be on the other side. I'd say in quant speak, that is really base your analysis and positions on a reputable theory about why you're going to get the return. Second thing you can do is you invest with a margin of safety. You've got Ben Graham speak for those who know it. That's really just saying invest with a confidence interval. Ideally, try to invest with skewness, more upside than downside. Third thing you do is evaluate investments against a range of scenarios. So don't rely on your view. Consider a whole distribution. And finally, you've got to continually test the foundations for a position and don't just set and forget. So you keep updating in a Bayesian sense, if you like. So that's what you can do. But basically, this is a really difficult problem. So it's hard to forecast the future in the first place. It's hard to know if you will be successful for sure because things change. The difficulty is it interacts with all the agency problems. And the problem is investment organisations are set up like this. Each of them is a principal-agency relationship. There's a whole chain of it. There's somebody who's delegating an investment task down to the next person, down to the next person, down to the next person, down to the next person. And it brings rise a whole lot of alignment and monitoring issues. For instance, the principals in this chain must monitor the agents on an ongoing basis. They do not have the option to say, we're a long-term investor, here's the money for 20 years, go away and do your best, and I'll come back and see. It doesn't work like that. You've got to continually work out if they're doing a good job. And what the 10 propensity is to do, you look at what's tangible, what's available, guess what? It's short-term results. So you tend to focus on it. Secondly, the incentive structures are built around it. And that is not only your bonuses, but also people's career prospects, and even status depends on how well they've done over the last year or two. You've probably all seen it in your organisations. Another problem is in our industry, fund flows respond to short-term performance. So if you do well, the money comes in. If you do poorly, the money goes out, and that drives the wheels in our business. And finally, benchmarks and peer comparisons. How do we monitor some of these agents? We give them a benchmark and judge them versus the performance of the benchmark. That benchmark anchors them. They get anchored to their peers. That's why people can't say, equity's too expensive, I'm selling them all. Nobody can do that in the system. They're anchored to their benchmarks and their peers. So what do we do about this? This is an idea. I'm going to attribute this. This is in one of the paper I got with David Neal. The intuition from this comes from him, basically, in this idea. But rather than remote monitoring, what you try and do is set up a series of what you came up with the term immersed monitoring. All we've done is just overlapped. The idea is at each level of the chain, you don't just monitor from a distance. You actually, the monitors of the agents try to understand what the agent is doing and why. And the idea there is to not judge them on the short-term results, but judge them on whether they are taking the right actions towards achieving long-term objectives. So it's very much of a subjective form of evaluation. Bring that into play. Say, we will reward you if you do the right thing to work towards long-term objectives. We're not going to reward you on generating a return for the next 6 or 12 months. Okay? As long as that return's bad, you're doing the right thing, that's fine. But what you need to do is have very close monitoring and build up understanding between the principal and agents about what is being done, why it's being done, and why it is working towards long-term objectives. So, I've come to the end now. So that's in our third paper in the trilogy, it deals about how you design an organisation for long-term investing. And it basically says there's four things you need to address to do this. I won't drill into this in detail, just mention what they are. First thing is you have to orientate the organisation so it's aligned in its organisational settings and build the range. That's basically the previous chart with the immersed monitoring. You have to set the right incentives so that you're measuring rewarding progression towards long-term goals, not short-term returns. Make sure you have a long-term investment approach and do what you can to harbour discretion over trading to the extent it is manageable, and not everybody can do that. So I might just stop there and see if we have got any more questions. That's it from me. That's one at the back there.
Hi. I thought one of the main advantages of long-term investing is the deferral of capital gains tax. So if you can find investments that compound at high returns of equity, you can hold them, and you can't find any better opportunities in the set out there, you can defer that capital gains tax and take advantage of compounding.
Yes. No, I agree. Yes, I do agree. You'll find that we didn't. I think tax only gets a very, very tangential reference in the document. I didn't really focus on it, but I do agree that is true. You can defer indefinitely and retain it. The only thing I would query is that should not. I'm a strong believer that should not stop you from trading. That should be actually modelled in that if I sell now and I pay a capital gains tax, I'm investing less dollars somewhere else. You could still do that transaction if that investment was going to generate higher rate of return than sitting in a lower performing investment even though you didn't pay capital gains tax. So you're just investing with less dollars. So I think that's the way you look at that question. And again, the whole thing is through the prism of long-term returns. It's just, is my long-term return over the next 10 or 20 years or whatever horizon I'm adopting going to be better from paying the tax now and remobilising that money versus sticking where I am? And a lot of people just don't do it because of the tax, but I think. But I do agree, that is an advantage you've got.
You mentioned this marginal, what's the marginal benefit of last investor? Like, if this occurs, like that, of course, last one will have higher price paid.
Yeah.
But you probably won't be the last one who will be trading with the last marginal investor. So in that case, like across the curve, what's the kind of point you were select as the last marginal investor?
It's often it's a good question. I'm trying to think out. I think I'm trying to sort of say you've got to take a more organic sort of approach to this, because what will happen is quite often you don't know who you're trading with in the market. And it'd be nice to sort of actually sort of work, map out the investor topography, if you want, of the buyers and sellers, and work out the supply and demand curves and saying, okay, well, how far am I away? You know, where am I bringing myself down to this point? I think in practice it probably won't work out like that, and you'll get this sort of information. It'll come through such as through things. If I've got a property example, reading in the press that there's people who are forced sellers because they're under pressure from the banks, or the banks are getting out of property, not funding property anymore. And then when you sort of go into the market, seeing the type of sellers that are there and what prices they're willing to deal at, and sort of making a judgment that that's really what's going on. And what could also happen is you could just say, at this price, I'm a buyer, put in your bid, and if somebody hits it because they're desperate enough, I'm set. And if they don't, you don't do it. And that way you ensure that you're at that point, that only happen to be the lucky only investor around that takes the marginal investor. So I'd say it's more sort of going to be seat of the pants organic type of thing that will go on rather than actually being able to trace it out exactly. And you also, very important to think, this is going to... it's going to evolve over time. It's going to change. It's going to shift. It's not.
Thank you. Just maybe what covers you in your follow-up paper, but I just wonder if long-term investors are more interested in money-weighted returns as a measure of investment performance versus time-weighted returns, because obviously the money-weighted returns reflects when they decide to put cash in and out, which seems to be what you're saying should be more of the discretion of the manager rather than higher up the hierarchy.
Yeah, okay. I must say, none of my papers talk about, none of those papers talk about money versus time-weighted returns, but I'm glad you raised it because it's all about money-weighted returns, isn't it, at the end of the day? And the only reason why we have time-weighted returns is so we can do performance evaluation, as far as I can see, unless anybody can think of any other reason. But fortunately, measure of returns of funds, measures skill of the manager, but unfortunately that's taken us over. But money-weighted returns are what really matter, and that's what we should be focusing on. And it's good to see the sort of debate over sequencing risk and the rest of it to make it rear its head, because that's what that's about. Well, again, I just have to agree. Don't really have a lot there.
I recently heard a terminology called investing with a super mega trend. So they were talking about like a 40 to 50 years horizon, and you pick up the trend that's going to happen in the future. For example, increasing demand in aged care, these kind of things.
That's my thematic investment bucket you're talking about, I think.
Oh, okay. I was about to ask, what's your view on this? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that those trends are in that thematic bucket. I agree. That's all part of the sort of strategies you can pursue. And often what happens with these sorts of things is it's very hard to identify exactly what the return from that trend is, but you sort of expect it to operate almost like a tide through your portfolio in some ways if you tilt it that way. I know that if you have a look at a report, there's about five trends the Future Fund, for instance, identified, when we're describing what they do, that they follow. But different investors have different things. But I agree, that's part of the mix.
So just in terms of practically implementing this, so say you could put it together and you could assure that you'd have a locked-in capital source with full discretion over it.
Yeah.
What, in your perspective, would be the minimum amount of time that you'd need to be able to guarantee to get positive or good returns for the market?
I think somebody's trying to get me to put a number on it.
No, you don't need
to. No, I think it's fair enough. No, well, I think if you have a look at the private equity model, they tend to operate on a 10-year horizon with, sort of 1 or 2 years extra scope to go. I think that sort of tends to tell you the horizon which they think it operates. That sort of makes sense to me. This is not an endorsement for private equity, by the way, because but they're not the ones that make the money out of this arrangement. I mean, they're the ones that make the money, not the investors all the time. But it does allow them to pursue those sort of strategies. The other thing is you could say, all right, well, how long does it take for value to be secured and realised out of some of those bigger liquid assets classes like property and infrastructure and so on? You probably are coming down to decade, sure. I think. On value investing, how long does it take for markets to realise value? It's usually, it could be, yeah, I think, from I've tried to do some reading on this, and the market tends to follow momentum over 6 to 9 months, but its mean reversion tends to happen at a 3-year horizon. That seems to be, it seems to pop up a number of times. So, again, you probably want to be out beyond sort of that. So it's sort of pushing me into 3 years minimum, 10 years maximum, to sort of the right, you should be setting your sights, sorry, 3 years to 10 years as the minimum sights you should have.
Thank you.
Sorry to try and trap you again, but earlier you referred to the future fund having 2020 as some sort of change. Does that suggest that we taxpayers have a problem about now in 2016, that if we don't get that 2020 pushed out, the future fund becomes a present fund?
It is possible. I think what happens then is it's left in the whims of the political gods to say it's for our advantage just to leave them alone and not pester them, and you can never tell that that will be the case with the government. But I mean, the sensible thing for them to do would be just allow the independents to say, and the only thing is then they may be in rundown mode, and they may change their strategies if you're in rundown mode, but that's fine. Thing, just leave them to manage that rundown, you know, with a 10 or 20 or 30 or 40 year horizon, rather than sort of bringing in other sorts of extraneous objectives into it, would be the right way to go. And that could easily happen, but I think it depends on the government in question, and they're like, and you always have a risk, I guess, that the new crowd comes in with a different objective. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that.
Oh, I think you have answered it. I think as soon as you said it depends on the government of the day, that answers that illustrates the problem.
Yes, it does. Yeah, I think New Zealand Super has a bit further to go. An extra 3 or 4 years. Oh, I should say, though, the board is independent. They've established that the Board of Guardians is supposedly independent. So they have to come in over the top of the board. But of course, that doesn't mean governments can't do what they want.
Good day. I just wanted to ask, do you have a view on whether the macro environment can help or hinder long-term investing? For example, in the current lower growth, lower inflation expectation environment, does that make it harder to commit to a new long-term investment strategy?
It's a really good question. I think the macro environment is always problematic for long-term investing. I'll go back to the slide about the long-term is difficult to forecast. Maybe share an anecdote about what my concerns are here, is that when I was doing this research, so the Future Fund was putting an input, but we also shared with a couple other funds, including NZ Super, and what's really interesting is how they had different perspectives about how they could do long-term investing and exploit macroeconomic and market fluctuations. And the NZ Super does a thing called strategic tilting, which is very much a mean reverting strategy, right? It says we can work out the value in the market. When they're at an extreme, we take the other position. When you go to the Future Fund, they're actually really focused on, or they express more focus on the path and more focus on their inability to forecast the long run and how you had to be all dynamic about it. And so the way they sort of look at it is it's more like managing your way through an uncertain economic environment. We recognise our ability not to to always identify value and recognise that the future will in fact change. So they've got a long horizon, but the way they manage it is quite different. And I think I'm personally a believer in mean reversion, you can do it, but I think it really needs that overlay in it to say that the macro environment is very unstable and has been unstable and will always be unstable, and that you can't put your long-term investing on an assumption that you can forecast that it will be stable. And that's the way to do it. And it's really in a frame of mind. So it's all right to invest in the long run, but don't invest too much in your confidence in your ability to forecast future macro environments successfully. But what you can do is, if you can see that infrastructure is overcooked because there's all these funds getting into it, I avoid that, and we're having a property collapse here. We'll get into that. Another sort of good example, again, the future fund example, is when after the GFC, when banks in Europe stopped lending, they went to an external manager. They have to operate through external managers and set up some sort of fund manager to lend money into the medium-sized corporates in Europe on the notion the banks weren't lending in here and there were very wide spreads being available. That's an example, I'd say, of there's a situation here where short-termism is created a dislocation in the market. We will try and take advantage of that and we'll set ourselves up to do it. So I think when you sort of invest, rather than relying on your ability to forecast the macro environment, if you go for these other things, such as where's the opportunity, why is the opportunity there, you might actually end up with a lot more solid way of doing it, and sort of a different mindset than the macroeconomic forecasting mindset. I used to be an ex-market strategist and economist, so I know how wrong you can get it. Looks like I might have exhausted everybody and myself. Is that it? I think we're good. Thank you very much for coming, and please, if they're all free if you want to access any of them. So please do. Thank you.